The Hermit by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 10. The old hermit improved visibly under the influence of hot tea, with a pat of butter and a good helping of sugar. The barley was fine ground and well roasted. The flames from the fire shone cheeringly through the entrance to the cave, but the hour was still that between dusk and dawn, with the birds asleep in the branches and nothing but night creatures astir. The moon had sailed across the sky and was now lowering herself beyond the farthest range. From time to time, the chill wind of the night came rustling through the leaves to send the sparks a-flying from the brightened fire. The ancient man rose warily on stiffened limbs and tottered off into the inner chamber. The young monk rolled over and fell into a sound sleep before his head touched the hard-packed sand. The world about was silent. The night became darker with the darkness that foretells of the dawn soon to come. From above, a solitary stone came rattling down to shatter on the boulders beneath. Then all was silent again. The sun was well advanced when the young monk awakened to a world of aches, stiff limbs, tired muscles, and hunger. Muttering forbidden words under his breath, he clambered up to his feet, grabbed the empty water can, and lurched out of the cave. The fire was a pleasant glow of red ashes. Hastily he tossed on small twigs and laid larger branches on top. Ruefully he surveyed the fast diminishing supply of wood. Gloomily he contemplated the difficulty of obtaining fresh supplies from ever and ever further afield. Glancing up at the rock face, he shuddered involuntarily as he had contemplated his climb of the night. Then off to the lake for water. "We must talk long today," said the old hermit as they finished their meager breakfast, "for I feel the heavenly fields calling upon me to hurry. There is a limit to what flesh can endure, and I have far outlived man's allotted span." The young man looked sad. He had developed a deep affection and respect for the old one, and considered that his suffering had been far too great. "I am ready when you are, venerable one," he said. "Let me just fill your bowl with water first." Rising, he swilled out the bowl and refilled it with fresh water. The old hermit commenced. "The ark appeared in the screen before me, vast and cumbersome, a vessel which would have engulfed the Potala and the whole city of Lhasa, complete with Sarah and Drepung lamasaries. It bulked so huge that the humans streaming from it were, by comparison, as small as the ants which worked in the sand. Vast animals were unloaded, and crowds of new humans. All appeared dazed, doped, presumably so they should not fight. Men with strange things on their shoulders flew about as the birds fly, herding the animals and men, prodding them with rods made of metal. Around the world the ship flew, landing at many points to leave behind animals of different types. Humans who were white, those who were black, and some were yellow. Short humans, tall humans, humans with black hair and those whose hair was white, animals with stripes, animals with long necks, some with no necks. Never had I known there could be such a range of colors, sizes, and different types of living creatures. Some of the sea creatures were so utterly immense that I could not for a time comprehend how they could move. Yet in the sea they appear as agile as the fishes in our lakes. Constantly through the air there flew small vessels which had in them people who were keeping check on the new inhabitants of Earth. On their forays, they dispersed large herds and made sure that animals and humans were spread over the globe. The centuries passed, and man still was not able to light a fire, nor even shape a crude implement of stone. The wise ones held conferences and decided that the stock must be improved by introducing some humanoids who were more intelligent, who knew how to light fires and work flints. So the centuries went on, with the gardeners of the earth introducing fresh virile specimens to improve the human stock. Gradually, mankind progressed from the flint-chipping stage to the fire-lighting level. Gradually, houses were built and towns formed. Always, the gardeners moved among the human creatures, and the humans looked upon them as gods upon the earth. The voice broke in, saying, "No useful purpose would be served in merely following the endless troubles which beset this new colony of earth. I will tell you of the salient features for the sake of your own instruction. While I speak, we will have before us suitably phased pictures so that you may also see any point of note." The empire was great, but there came from another universe violent people who tried to wrest our possessions from us. These people were humanoid, and upon their head they had horny growths projecting from the area of the temples. They also had a tail. These people were of a surprisingly warlike nature. It was their sport as well as their work. In black ships they poured into this universe and laid waste to worlds which we had so recently seeded. In space, cataclysmic battles took place. Worlds were laid desolate. Worlds erupted into the gouts of smoke and flame, and their debris clutters the spaceways as the asteroid belt, even to this day. Previously, fertile worlds had their atmosphere blasted away, and all that lived there perished. A world struck another world a glancing blow, and threw it against the earth. The earth juddered and shook and was pushed into another orbit, which made the earth day longer. During the near collision, giant electric discharges leaped from the two worlds. The skies flamed anew. Many of the earth humans perished. Great floods swept the surface of the world, and compassionate gardeners hurried around in their arks trying to load aboard humans and animals that they should be safely conveyed to higher ground and safety. "In later years," said the voice, "this would give rise to incorrect legends throughout all earth lands. But in space, the battle was won. The forces of the empire defeated the evil invaders and made many of them captive." The prince of the invaders, Prince Satan, pled for his life, saying that he had much to teach the peoples of the empire, saying that he would at all times work for the good of others. His life and that of some of his leading men were spared. After a period of captivity, he expressed himself as anxious to cooperate in the rebuilding of the solar system which he had so desecrated. Being men of goodwill, The Empire admirals and generals could not imagine treachery and evil intent in others. They accepted the offer and set the Prince Satan and his officers' tasks under the supervision of Empire men. On the earth, the natives were crazed by the experiences they had undergone. They had been decimated by the inundation and by the flames from the clouds. Fresh stock was brought from outlying planets where some humans had survived. The lands were now different. The seas were different. Through the complete change in orbit, the climate had altered. Now there was a hot equatorial belt, and ice formed very heavily on the polar areas. Icebergs broke away from the main masses and floated in the seas. Huge animals died in the sudden cold. Forests collapsed when their living conditions changed so drastically. Very slowly, conditions became stabilized. Once again, man started to build a form of civilization. But man was now excessively warlike and persecuted all those who were weaker. Routinely, the gardeners introduced fresh specimens that the basic stock should be improved. The evolution of man progressed, and a better type of creature slowly emerged. But the gardeners were not satisfied. It was decided that more gardeners should live upon the earth, gardeners and their families. For convenience, mountaintops or high places were used as bases. Over an eastern land, the man and woman descended in their spaceship and made their base on a pleasant mountain rise. Izanagi and Izanami became the protectors and founders of the Japanese race. The voice sounded both rueful and cross at the same time. Once again, false legends were woven, because these two, Izanagi and Izanami, appeared from the direction of the sun. The natives believed they were the sun god and goddess come to live among them. On the screen before me, I saw the blood-red sun shining full in the sky. As from it, there descended a shining vessel, colored red by the reflected rays of the setting sun. The ship descended further, hovered, and then lazily circled around. At last, as red rays from the evening sun were reflected on the snow-covered mountain top, the ship descended on a level slope high on the mountain side. The last beams of sunlight lit up the man and woman who descended from the ship to look about them, and then to re-enter. The yellow-skinned natives lying prostrate before the ship, overawed by the glory of the sight, waited in respectful silence, then melted away in the darkness of the night. The picture changed, and I saw another mountain in a far-off land, where I knew not, but that information was soon to be given to me. From the sky there came spaceships which circled about and then slowly descended in a regular formation until they too occupied a mountain slope. "The gods of Olympus," said the voice in a sarcastic tone, "the so-called gods who brought much trial and tribulation to this young world. These people, with the former Prince Satan among them, came to settle upon the earth, but the center of the empire was far away. Laziness and the promptings of Satan led astray these young men and women who had been given this earth assignment that they could gain experience. Zeus, Apollo, Theseus, Aphrodite, the daughters of Cadmus, and many others, formed these crews. The messenger Mercury sped from ship to ship throughout the world, carrying messages and scandals. Men became overwhelmed with desire for the wives of others. Women set themselves to trap men they desired. Across the skies of the world there were mad chases in speeding craft as woman chased man or husband chased eloping wives. And the ignorant natives of the world watched the sex antics of those whom they deemed to be gods, thought that this was the way in which they should live. So there began an era of debauchery in which all the laws of decency were flouted. Various wily natives, more alert than the average, set themselves up as priests and pretended to be the voice of the gods. The gods were too busy with their orgies to even know. But these orgies led to other excesses, led to murders so numerous that, at long last, news of them filtered back to the empire. But the native priests, those who pretended to be the representatives of the gods, wrote down all that happened and altered sayings that their own powers might be increased. Ever it has been thus in the history of the world that some of the natives wrote down not what happened, but that which would enhance their own power and prestige. Most of the legends are not even an approximation of that which really took place. I was moved to another screen. Here were another group of gardeners or gods: Horus, Osiris, Anubis, Isis, and many others. Here, too, orgies were occurring. Here, too, a former lieutenant of Prince Satan was at work, trying to sabotage all the efforts to produce good for this little world. Here, too, were the inevitable priests writing their endless and inaccurate legends. Some there were who had wormed their way into the confidence of the gods and had so obtained knowledge normally forbidden to the natives for their own good. These natives formed a secret society designed to steal more forbidden information and to usurp the power of the gardeners. But the voice continued to speak. We had much trouble with certain of the natives and had to introduce measures which were repressive. Certain of the native priests, having stolen equipment from the gardeners, could not control them. They loosened plagues upon the earth. Vast numbers of the people died. Crops were affected. But certain of the gardeners, under the control of Prince Satan, had established a capital of sin in the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. Cities in which any form of vice or perversion or depravity was considered as virtue. The master of the empire solemnly warned Satan to desist and leave, but he scoffed. Certain of the better inhabitants of Sodom and Gomorrah were advised to leave, and then, at the appointed time, a solitary craft sped through the air and dropped a small package. The cities were erased in flame and smoke. Great mushroom-shaped clouds ascended into the quaking sky, and upon the ground there was nothing but devastation, rubble of stones, melted rocks, and the incredible debris of human habitation in decay. By night the area shone with a sickly purple radiance. Very few escaped the Holocaust. Following this salutary warning, it was decided to withdraw all the gardeners from the face of the earth and to have no more contact with the natives, but to treat them as specimens from afar. Patrols would still enter the atmosphere, the world and its natives would still be supervised, but no official contact. Instead, it was decided to have upon the earth natives who had been specially trained and who could be planted where suitable people would find them. The man who later became known as Moses was an example. A suitable native woman was removed from the earth and impregnated with the seed having the necessary characteristics. The unborn child was telepathically trained and given great, for a native, knowledge. He was hypnotically conditioned not to reveal the knowledge until an appointed time. In due course, the baby was born, and further training and conditioning was given. Later, the baby was placed in a suitable container and, under cover of darkness, was deposited securely in a bed of reeds where he would speedily be found. As he grew to manhood, he was in frequent touch with us. When necessary, a small ship would come to a mountain and be concealed by the natural clouds, or even by those which we made ourselves. The man Moses would then ascend the mountain and come aboard, leaving after with a wand of power or specially compiled tablets of the commandments which we had prepared for him. But this still was not enough. We had to go through a similar procedure in other countries. In that land, which is now known as India, we specially controlled and trained the male child of a most powerful prince. We considered that his power and prestige would induce the natives to follow him and adhere to a special form of discipline, which we had formulated that there should be an improvement in the spiritual state of the natives. Gotama had his own ideas, however, and rather than discard him, we allowed him to produce his own form of spiritual discipline. Once again, we found that the disciples or priests, usually for their own gain, distorted the teachings in their writings. Thus it ever was upon the earth, a coterie of men, self-styled priests, would edit or rewrite scriptures that their own powers and wealth should be enhanced. There were others who founded new branches of religion, such as Muhammad, Confucius, the names are too many to mention, but each of these men was under our control or trained by us with the basic intention that a world belief should be established. The leaders of that religion would then lead their followers into good ways of life. We intended that each human should behave to others as he himself would wish others to behave towards him. We tried to establish a state of universal harmony such as existed in our own empire. But this new humanity was not yet sufficiently advanced to put aside self and to work for the good of others. The wise ones were very dissatisfied with progress. As a result of their cerebration, a new scheme was propounded. One of the wise ones had remarked that all those sent to earth, so far, had been introduced to the wealthier type of family. As he correctly stated, many of the lower classes would reject automatically the words of such a higher class person. Thus it was that the search was made, first using the Akashic record, for a suitable woman to bear a son. A suitable woman from a suitable lower-class family, and in a country wherein it was considered that a new religion or doctrine might be expected to flourish. Researchers assiduously devoted themselves to the task. A fair number of possibilities were presented. 3 men and 3 women were secretly landed upon the earth in order that they could pursue their investigations so that the most suitable family should be selected. The consensus of opinion favored a young woman who was childless and married to a practitioner of the oldest trade on earth, the trade of carpenter. The wise ones reasoned that the majority of people were of this class, and they may be more willing to follow the words of one of their own. So the woman was visited by one of us, whom she took to be an angel, and told that she was to have a great honor, that she was to bear a male child who was to found a new religion. In the fullness of time, the woman became pregnant, but then occurred one of those events so common in that part of the world. The woman and her husband had to flee their home because of the persecution of a local king. They made their way slowly to a Middle Eastern city, and there the woman found that her time was full upon her. There was no place to go except in a stable of a hostelry. There the baby was born. We had followed the flight, prepared to take all necessary action. 3 members of the crew of the vigilant vessel descended to the surface of the earth and made their way to the stable. To their dismay, they learned that the ship had been seen and was being described as a star in the east. The baby grew into boyhood, and through the special indoctrination he constantly received by telepathy, he showed great promise. As a youth, he would dispute with his elders, and, regrettably, he antagonized the local priesthood. In early manhood, he withdrew from those he knew and traveled to many other lands in the Middle and Far East. We directed him to travel to Tibet, and he crossed the mountain range and sojourned for a time in the Cathedral of Lhasa, where, even now, the prints of his hands are preserved. Here he received advice and assistance in the formulation of a religion suitable for Western peoples. During his stay in Lhasa, he underwent special treatment in which the astral body of the earth human was freed and taken away to another existence. In its place was inserted the astral body of one of our choosing. This was a person with very great experience in spiritual matters, far greater experience than could be obtained under any earth conditions. This system of transmigration is one we frequently employ when dealing with backward races. At last everything was ready, and he made the long journey back to his homeland. Arrived there, he was successful in recruiting certain acquaintances who would assist with the dissemination of the new religion. Unfortunately, the first occupant of the body had antagonized the priests. Now they remembered the fact and carefully arranged an incident under which the man could be arrested. Having control of the judge who tried the matter, the result was a foregone conclusion. We considered effecting a rescue, but K came to the conclusion that the overall result would be bad for the general population and for the new religion. The new form of spiritual discipline spread, but once again there were those who subverted it to their own ends. About 60 years after its inception, a large convention was held in the Middle East city of Constantinople. Here many priests foregathered, many of them perverted men who had depraved sexual desires and who looked upon heterosexuality as unclean. Under their majority vote, the real teachings were altered and made women appear unclean. They now taught quite erroneously that all children are born in sin. They decided to publish a book about the events of 60 years before. Writers were hired to compile books on the same lines, using, as far as possible, the tales and the legends which had been passed down, with all their inaccuracies, from person to person. For year after year, various committees sat to edit, delete, and alter passages which did not please them. Eventually, a book was written which did not teach the real belief, but which was, in effect, advertising material to enhance the power of the priesthood. Throughout the centuries which followed, the priests, who should have been assisting the development of mankind, actively hindered it. False legends have been propagated. Facts have been distorted. Unless the people of the earth, and particularly the evil priests, changed their ways, we, the people of the empire, will have to take over the earth world. Meantime, except in such extreme cases as this, we have orders not to converse with man and to make no overtures to any government on earth. The voice ceased to speak. I floated numbly before those ever-changing screens, watching the pictures as they brought to my vision all that had happened in those days of long ago. I saw, too, much of the probable future, for the future can be accurately predicted for a world or even for a country. I saw my own dear land being invaded by the hated Chinese. I saw the rise and fall of an evil political regime which seemed to have a name like communism, but this meant nothing to me. At last I felt extreme exhaustion. I felt that even my astral body was wilting under the strain which had been placed upon it. The screens, hitherto so full of living color, turned gray. My vision blurred, and I fell into a state of unconsciousness. A horrid rocking motion awakened me from my sleep, or from the state of unconsciousness. I opened my eyes, but I had no eyes. Although I could still not move, I was in some way aware that I was again in my physical body. The rocking was the table, which bore me being carried back along the space vessel corridor. An unemotional voice flatly stated, "He is conscious." A grunt of acknowledgement followed, and there was silence again, except for the shuffling of feet and the faint scraping of metal, as at times my table was bumped against the wall. I lay alone in that metal room. The men had deposited my table and silently withdrawn. I lay pondering the marvels that had befallen me, yet feeling a little resentful. The constant tirade about priests. I was a priest. and they were glad enough to make use of my unwilling services. As I rested broodingly, I heard the metal panel slide aside. A man entered and slid shut the door behind him. "Well, monk," exclaimed the voice of the doctor, "you have done well. We are very proud of you. While you lay unconscious, we examined again your brain, and our instruments tell us that you have all the knowledge locked inside your brain cells. You have taught our young men and women much. Soon you'll be released. Does that make you happy?" "Happy, Sir Doctor?" I queried. "What have I to be happy about? You capture me, you cut off the top of my head, you force my spirit out of my body, you insult me as a member of the priesthood, and now, having used me, you're going to discard me like a man casting off his tattered body at death. Happy? What have I to be happy about? Are you going to restore my eyes? Are you going to provide a living for me? How am I going to exist otherwise?" I almost snarled the latter. "One of the main troubles of the world, monk," mused the doctor, "is that most of your people are negative. No one could say that you are negative. You positively say what you mean. If you people would always think positively, there would be no trouble with the world, for the negative condition comes naturally to people here, although it actually takes more effort to be negative." "But, Sir Doctor," I exclaimed, "I asked what you were going to do for me. How shall I live? What shall I do? Do I just have to retain this knowledge until someone comes along who says he's the man, and then babble everything like an old woman in the marketplace? And why do you think I will do my alleged task, thinking as you do about priests?" "Monk," said the doctor, "we shall place you in a comfortable cave with a nice stone floor. It will have a very small trickle of water, which will supply your needs in that direction. As for food, your priestly state will ensure that people bring you food. Again, there are priests and priests. Your priests of Tibet are mainly good, and we have no quarrel with them. Did you not observe that we have previously used the priests of Tibet? And you ask about him to whom you shall give your knowledge? Remember this. You will know when the person comes. Give your knowledge to him and to none other." So I lay there entirely at their mercy. But after many hours, the doctor came in my room again, saying, "Now you shall be restored to movement. First, we have a new robe for you, and also a new bowl." Hands were busy by me. Strange things were plucked out of me. My sheet was removed, and the new robe, a new one, the first new robe I ever had, was placed about me. Then movement returned to me. Some male attendant placed an arm around my shoulder and eased me over the edge of the table. For the first time in an unknown number of days, I again stood upon my feet. That night I rested more content, wrapped in a blanket which had also been given to me, and on the morrow I was taken, as I've already told you, and deposited in the cave where I have lived alone for more than 60 years. But now, before we rest for the night, let us have a little tea, for my task is at an end. End of chapter 10. Chapter 11. The young monk sat up abruptly, the nape of his neck bristling with fright. Something had brushed by him. Something had trailed icy fingers across his forehead. For long moments he sat bolt upright, straining his ears for even the slightest sign of a sound. Wide-eyed and staring, he strove in vain to pierce the utter blackness around him. Nothing moved. No vestige of noise made the slightest ripple on his consciousness. The entrance to the cave was a mere lighter blackness, vaguely etched on the entire lack of light engulfing the cave. He held his breath, listening until he could hear the pounding of his own heart and the faint creakings and wheezes from his own organs. No rustle of sound from wind-disturbed leaves cheered him. No creature of the night called. Silence. The absolute lack of noise, which is known but to a few, and to none in populated communities. Again, light tendrils wandered across his head. With a squeak of fright, he leaped high into the air, his legs running even before he hit the ground. Dashing out of the cave, perspiring with fright, he stooped hastily over the well-banked fire. Throwing aside the enclosing earth and sand, he uncovered the red glow. Quickly he thrust in a well-dried branch and blew on the embers until it seemed his blood vessels must burst under the strain. At last the wood burst into flame. Grasping it in one hand, he hastily inserted another stick and waited for it, too, to flare into light. At last, with a burning branch in each hand, he slowly re-entered the cave. The flickering flames leaped and danced to his movements. His shadow was thrown grotesque and huge on either side of him. Nervously he peered about. Anxiously he searched in hope that it had been a spider's web trailing across his arm, but of that there was no sign. Then he thought of the old hermit, and he berated himself for not thinking of him before. "Venerable one," he called tremulously, "are you all right?" With straining ears he listened, but there was no reply, not even an echo. Dubiously he made his slow, frightened way forward, with the two flaring branches thrust well before him. At the end of the cave he turned right, where he had not entered before, and uttered a pent-up gasp of relief as he saw the old man sitting in the lotus position at the far end of a smaller cave. A strange flash, caught his attention as he was about to silently withdraw. Staring hard, he saw that water was emerging from a rocky protrusion as drop, drop, drop. Now the young monk was calmer. "I am sorry I intruded, venerable one," he said. "I feared you were ill. I will leave you." But there was no reply, no movement. The old man sat as still as a stone statue. Apprehensively the young man advanced and then stood for a moment studying the motionless figure. At last, fearfully, he extended his arm and touched the old one on the shoulder. The spirit had withdrawn. Previously, bedazzled by the flickering flames, he had not thought about the aura. Now he perceived that that too had faded and gone out. Sadly, the young man sat cross-legged in front of the corpse and recited the age-old ritual for the dead, giving instructions for the journeyings of the spirit on the way to the heavenly fields. Warnings of possible dangers laid before him in his confused state of mind by mischievous entities. At last, his religious obligations fulfilled, he slowly rose to his feet, bowed to the dead figure, and, torches having long burned out, felt his way out of the cave. The pre-dawn wind was just rising and began moaning eerily through the trees. A wild keening came from a rocky fissure across which the wind was blowing and making a high organ note of dismal sound. Slowly the first faint streaks of light appeared in the morning sky, and the far edge of the mountain range could now be distinguished. The young monk crouched miserably beside the fire, wondering what to do next, thinking of the grisly task before him. Time seemed to stand still, but at last, after what seemed to be an infinity of ages, the sun advanced and there was daylight. The young monk thrust a branch in the fire and waited patiently until the end burst into flame. Then, reluctantly, he grasped the flaming branch and advanced with trembling lights into the cave and into the inner chamber. The body of the old hermit was sitting as though he were still alive. Apprehensively, the young monk bent and lifted the old body. Without much effort, he raised it and draped it across his shoulders. Staggering a little, he made his way out of the cave and along the side of the mountain where the big flat stone was waiting. The vultures were waiting, too. Slowly, the young man removed the robe from the wasted body and felt instant compassion at the sight of the skeleton-thin frame with the skin so tightly stretched. Shuddering with revulsion, he jabbed the sharp-edged flint into the lower abdomen and pulled up hard. The tearing gristle and fibrous muscle made a dreadful sound, which alerted the vultures and brought them hopping nearer. With the body exposed and the body cavity gaping open, the young man raised a heavy rock and brought it down upon the skull so that the brains came tumbling out. Then, with tears streaming down his cheeks, he picked up the old hermit's robe and bowl and trudged back to the cave, leaving the vultures quarreling and fighting behind him. Into the fire he tossed the robe and bowl, watching as the flames so quickly consumed them. Sadly, with tears plopping down to the thirsty ground, he turned away and trudged slowly down the path towards another phase of life. End of chapter 11 and end of The Hermit.